Today on the 21st Show, the writer George Packer. He's best known for his journalism at The Atlantic magazine and before that, The New Yorker. He's also written books on American politics and foreign affairs. But late last year, he came out with a novel called The Emergency. It imagines an empire in collapse, with new ways of thinking upending not just civic life, but workplaces and even individual families. Ultimately, it raises the question, what do we owe each other when things fall apart? I'm Brian Mackey with George Packer for The Hour, today on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WNIJ in Rockford DeKalb, WVIK in the Quad Cities, and WSIU in Carbondale. But first, news. From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Before we begin today, a programming note. We were originally scheduled to talk with Steve Botsford, one of the Democrats running for Senate in the primary this year. He asked us to postpone our conversation because of some personal circumstances. We still hope to have him on before the election. Because of that last-minute change, today we're listening back to my conversation with the writer George Packer. You may have read his long-form journalism on American politics and foreign policy in The Atlantic magazine, where he's been on staff since 2018. Before that, he spent 15 years at The New Yorker. Packer is also the author of many books, including The Assassin's Gate from 2005 about the war in Iraq, and The Unwinding, an Inner History of the New America. That won the National Book Award in 2013. He also edited two excellent collections of George Orwell's essays. Now, for the first time in decades, he's written a novel. It's called The Emergency. It's about what happens when a government collapses and new ways of life take root in a society. This is an allegorical novel. Packer never specifies the time and place. Some aspects of their lives will be familiar to us, cars, advanced medicine, but others are kept deliberately strange, like the absolute lack of digital technology. Among the big questions here are what happens to the social contract when society is upended? What should we do with our personal codes when a new order deems them outmoded? And how do you respond when the revolution is happening, not just out in the streets, but at our own dinner tables? In November, we spoke with George about the book. We'll be revisiting that conversation for the hour today. On a personal note, I found The Emergency compelling enough that when I read it, I stayed up well past 3 in the morning to get to the end. No calls today, but you can let us know what you thought. Our email address is talk@21stshow.org. George Packer, it's a real pleasure to talk with you today. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for staying up very late to finish my book. I will take that as a tribute.
I couldn't put it down. So it also probably has something to do with what your former colleague Hendrik Hertzberg once described as his own undergraduate work habits. But that's a conversation for another day. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious about what is the origin story of The Emergency? As I said, you haven't written a novel in quite a long time.
Yeah, and those two novels that I did write way back in the 90s came and went without leaving much of a mark. So there was not an auspicious, sign that I should continue my efforts to become a novelist. Instead, I became a journalist, spent a couple of decades, as you said, with The New Yorker and now The Atlantic, and wrote a lot about what was happening in America, essentially charting our troubles and our decline as a society, as a world power, our relations with each other. And finally, I felt I had reached diminishing returns with journalism. Not that I'm giving it up, but that I needed to refresh my spirit from the usual facts, names, places, arguments, which seemed to become so repetitive and sort of soul-killing. And I thought that the imagination was the way to do it. And sometimes we need the imagination to see deeper truths than the facts allow us to see when we get too used to them. So I had been driving back and forth between New York City and the countryside quite a lot during the pandemic and after, and began to feel as if I was crossing an invisible line into another world each time I went back and forth between the urban and rural Americas. And that gave me the idea of a story of a man who has to do that, who has to go from the city to the countryside where there's danger because that society has begun to tear itself apart, to turn on itself. And that became the seed for what I did not want to write as a realistic novel, because I was trying to get away from the familiar, but instead as an allegory, a kind of dystopia, no obvious setting, no names that you would recognize, but themes and feelings that you might recognize. And that's what fiction allows, is to get below the facts to emotion, and that is what I try to do with The Emergency.
So you're writing here in the tradition, of course, of Orwell, Animal Farm, 1984. I've also heard comparisons to The Stranger from Camus. I personally was reminded of Cormac McCarthy's The Road. You know, it's not just a novel, but it's a big idea, capital A, allegorical novel, right? It's a big swing.
And this novel also has a parent and child, a father and daughter on a trip. And so, yeah, there's definitely a debt to The Road.
Yeah. So, well, talk about your decision to take it on in that way, as opposed to a more, I don't know if the term realistic or, you know, grounded would be the term, but take it where you will.
Well, those are some of my favorite books, the ones you mentioned. I would add J.M. Coetzee's Waiting for the Barbarians, the South African novelist. There's something sense opening about the complete escape from the present. You see reality more clearly when you're not distracted by the name Trump or the US Congress or gerrymandering, and instead you are seeing a new world built from scratch, and it can work on you, I think, in a deeper way than if it's a one-to-one correspondence or a Romana Clay where everything stands in for something that you already know. So I wanted to, in a sense, get as far away as I could in order to get as deep as I could. And that's allegory. That's what it allows you to do.
So you have, it's an empire. It collapses. We don't really know why. We don't really care, I think, because we're concerned with what comes next in one particular city, and then as you say, it spreads out into the countryside. Can you talk about some of the decisions you would have had to make early on, like how to identify the city folk and the country folk? And, you know, I wonder if it's difficult to make those commitments when you are taking a big swing like this, you know, even
sure.
with the terms you use.
I felt the need to come up with a new terminology for this world, and instead of what yuppies or MAGA or wokeness or the obvious current American terms, the city people are called burghers, which is a bit of a throwback to an earlier century in Europe. They're the educated class. They work in guilds. The guilds are rigid. You have to take an exam to enter a guild, and the guilds are the professions, basically law, medicine, etc. The main character is a doctor, a surgeon in the medical guild, who's quite successful in the city. And the city's not named. I just call it the city by the river, just as the empire isn't named. It's just the empire. And at some point, the empire collapses. I say it died of boredom and loss of faith in itself, which is a vague enough but kind of piquant enough cause. It's not like there's been an invasion or a revolution. It's just sort of slowly, like a marriage running out of love, it has lost faith. And in the collapse, a new order begins to rise up in the city that is essentially a youth rebellion with a philosophy called Together, which is sort of a utopian egalitarian ideology that wants to get rid of hierarchies, get rid of every trace of the old order, including the clubs that the guilds had for their members, and instead to organize the city by what I call self-org committees, which are essentially young people just on their own without leaders running things. And The key is that the surgeon's daughter, 14 years old, to whom he's always been very close, gets caught up in the excitement of this new order. And this is the emotional heart of it, is they become estranged. She rejects his values. He can't understand hers, wants to stay close to her, but also wants to instruct her, guide her away from what he thinks might be an intolerant new philosophy. And that relationship kind of takes you all the way through the novel. And meanwhile, we can get to this, but outside the city, outside the walls of the city, in the countryside, something equally exciting and disturbing is happening.
Yeah, I will say, as I started reading the book, and I heard your interview with Jeff Goldberg, where he talked to the editor of The Atlantic. He talked about, at the point where he stopped trying to say, okay, this is the Harper's Letter, or this, this thing analogizes to that. That's the manosphere. I found at some point I could more easily, as it went on, let go of trying to draw those comparisons. How do you insulate yourself from, from that, from being, because some things do overlap pretty tightly with, the restorative justice circles that we've seen recently, and call it, some like to call it cancel culture, if you will. How talk about your thought process there.
Yeah, those things do exist. They're under different names and sort of different modes. As you said, there's no digital technology. So there's no smartphones, there's no social media, there's no AI, but there are things that will remind you of social media and AI. As I began writing, the first scene I wrote was a scene at the hospital where the doctor, the surgeon, runs the operating room, and he's been called into a session in which actions of his that took place during surgery and that disturbed and kind of violated norms of other staff, he's called to account for it. And that's the first thing I wrote. And the first draft I wrote felt way too close to incidents of struggle sessions and cancel culture that we know from our own time. And I had to put it aside and start again with really essentially building the city. Almost literally, I was drawing maps and where's the clock tower? Where's the hospital? Where's the river? What does the warehouse district look like? And once I began to fill in the physical details and the pathways of the characters, I started getting further and further from the present and finding ways to estrange it, to make it weird. And then I came back to that hospital scene and rewrote it, and it felt more alive. It felt more like it belonged in this novel because the novel was taking me away from the familiar signposts. And with each page, with each chapter, with each part, I got more and more away from American reality today into this imagined world that has all kinds of things in it, not magic, not sci-fi, not fantasy, I'm not into that, but it has just disturbingly strange things go on, but that those things, if it's working, are going to echo something you already feel, but it's going to make you feel it more deeply. And that was sort of how I tried to get away from simply writing a journalistic novel about what's happening in America today.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the interesting elements that comes up in the story is this idea of different fact environments. When especially when the main character and his daughter venture out into the countryside, they, first in the city, people hear things about what's happening in the country and think, oh, there's some crazy stuff happening out there. Turns out in the country, they have some very crazy ideas about what's happening in the city. And there's a moment that where your main character sort of realizes, we just can't talk about this anymore. And you had a real life experience. I've heard you talk about this, where you had a moment like that. Can you tell that story? You're talking to a neighbor in upstate New York, I
This
think.
is
Yeah.
yeah. There was a moment when my neighbor in upstate New York, who is a farmer and a Trump supporter, and I made the mistake of getting into a political conversation, which I had tried to avoid pretty much for several years. And very quickly I realized we should not continue this conversation. There's no persuading each other. There's no agreement on basic facts as a starting point. There's not even an argument. It's a monologue. And in order to preserve a relationship that's important to me, I basically let him talk and then ended the conversation and never brought it up again. I think that goes on quite a lot in this country when people value a relationship and recognize that politics and just the question of what is real, what happened on January 6, 2021, can drive people into opposite corners where they simply can't understand each other. And the doctor in my novel, when he comes to that point with a farmer out in the countryside, is more frightened by that than by actual physical violence, the sense that that nothing is real. There are no solid facts that can be established. And instead, everyone is able to come up with a picture of reality of their own that has nothing to do with what might be happening. As you said, the people in the city imagine that there are these blood rites at midnight going on in the countryside. The people in the country imagine kind of perversions, sexual perversions going on in the city. And neither of those is true. But when you're divided physically and mentally, and when you begin each side to suspect the other of maybe plotting your downfall, these theories, these conspiracy theories, these fantasies become real, and you want them to be real. That's the thing. It's not like you're assessing them against evidence. You actually want to believe that about the other group because you fear them and you hate them, and that is what drives the plot of the novel.
Yeah, you say one of the characters, we need to take a break, but I like how you put it. One of the characters felt a need to know things that Rustin, the main character, didn't know. Things that drove a permanent wedge between them so they no longer inhabited the same world. It was something he desired. All right, let me remind listeners, we are listening back to my conversation with George Packer, first recorded in November. We're going to continue after a short break. This is The 21st Show.
Support for The 21st Show comes from the Des Moines Arts Center, presenting Manuel Alvarez Bravo, a pioneer of Mexican photography, featuring collaborators like Frida Kahlo, Diego Rivera, and more. On view through January 18th. More information at DesMoinesArtsCenter.org.
It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're listening back to my conversation with the writer George Packer. His new novel is called The Emergency, an allegory of an empire in collapse and what happens to this society when young people take over, old social mores are cast aside, and danger is looming outside the city walls. No calls because we're on tape, but our email address is talk@21stshow.org. You had a piece in The Atlantic a few years ago called The Moral Case Against Equity Language. I found that quite powerful when I read it, and I heard a lot of echoes in that as I was reading through The Emergency. Can you give listeners a sense of what your argument was there, and then maybe we can talk about how, you know, that some of those ideas made their way into your book?
I had got hold of a document called An Equity Language Guide that the Sierra Club put out for its staff. And it turns out a lot of nonprofits and universities were releasing these guides, basically what kinds of words might be offensive, what kinds of words not to use, what words to use instead. And the list was astonishing. Words like stand or country or blind or brown bag lunch were all on the banned list. And the replacements were jargony, multi-syllabic words. For example, you can't say poor, as in poor people. You have to say something more like marginalized. And then even marginalized had become a quote, problematic word. So I was wondering, what is going on here? Why is the Sierra Club and all these other groups and a lot of individuals trying to purge language of any trace of injustice or bias or hierarchy? And what's the effect? And to me, the effect is you cannot name and thereby face and thereby change reality. Instead, you're releasing great clouds of euphemism that hide reality and therefore make it impossible to change it. So it has the opposite effect of what's intended. It might make you feel better about yourself and your own moral standing, but it actually gives you the sense of having achieved something when in fact what you've done is make it harder to think and harder to speak about ugly facts that have to be confronted. So in the novel, Together, which is the philosophy of the young people in the city, begins to change the language people use in a way that makes it seem more just, more equal, more in keeping with the principles of Together, but in fact turns it into a kind of language of euphemism. And the doctor, this is the key thing, the doctor tries to go along with it at first and then sort of finds himself rejecting it. And it's his rejection of the new language and of the new thinking that gets him in trouble and finally gets him disgraced and ostracized from the hospital, which is what sets the rest of the plot in motion.
Say more about the harm there, because I think some people will hear that and think, look, what's wrong with being more equitable, right? Trying to be inclusive or human-centered language. What damage does that do?
I mean, it's nobly intended. I acknowledge the moral impulse behind it. But to me, as a writer, language should be clear. Language should be strong. Language should be capable of disturbing us. It should not swaddle us in comforting phrases. Because if it does, a kind of complacency sets in, an insider language that allows those in the know to feel as if they've achieved a certain status, and those who are not in the know might feel left out and even resentful that their words are being taken away from them, and they're being told, well, yesterday you could say Latino, but today you have to say Latinx. And if you are Latino, you might not want to be told that. You might want to be able to use the term you've always used. So it has this kind of a way of creating a new hierarchy, those in the know and those not. And mostly as a writer, for me, I think it makes communication much harder and much more likely to be false. And what I like is simple, blunt language that allows you to see and therefore to think and therefore to act. And once the fog of euphemism gets in the way, that process breaks down.
All right, let me remind listeners, we're listening back to my conversation with George Packer. No calls today because we're on tape, but we did take calls when we originally broadcast this back in November. And let's go now to the phones, where Doug is calling from Naperville on line one. Doug, thank you for calling in.
Thank you, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. Mr. Packer, really enjoyed your work. Deeply grateful to you for all the books you've written. I've read many of them. And I call with this experience here in Illinois. I lived in Freeport, Northwest Illinois community, for 11 years as a United Methodist pastor. And we moved into the community in 1996. It was a thriving community in its economy. And in 2007, when we left, the globalization just really wiped out the community. I remember, you know, trying to use Tom Friedman's arguments with the laity of the church and the community, and the anger that built up over those years. And I think anger that I find more and more convincing and very genuine, the creating the kind of elitism that leading to Donald Trump's election. I remember David Brooks in his column the morning after the 2024 election pointing to this, and I wouldn't be grateful for your thoughts. Are we in the educated community, is there a need to search our conscience, the kind of elitism that's created anger in communities that you're describing in the emergency? Now, thank you.
Thanks, Doug, for reading me. There's no writing without reading. And yeah, absolutely. I wrote about what you're describing quite a lot in my nonfiction, especially in The Unwinding. And there's a strong element of that in The Emergency. There's a very sharp division between the city and the countryside. It's almost physical. There's a wall around the city. It has gates, almost like a medieval city. And there's something a bit threatening about leaving the city for the countryside. And once you're out there, once the doctor and his daughter leave the city on this humanitarian mission and go out into the countryside, they discover that the empire that once existed and that told everyone we're all part of the same empire, and now that it no longer exists, these resentments have begun to reach the surface that were always there but had been hidden out of a sense that we have to get along. And now the resentment is so intense on the part of the rural people, who I call yeomen, that the threat of violence is always there. So it's exaggerated, you know, it has that satirical element of a novel, but it's pointing to something that I feel whenever I leave the big metropolitan areas of America, and within 10, 20 miles, I'm in small towns and rural areas that are suffering, that have been left behind. It became a nationwide phenomenon, and the fact that we in the elite world, in the educated metropolitan world, sort of said, well, you have to get with the program and get on the train because globalization is a fact like the sunrise. There's nothing I can do about it. You just have to get a different education and get retrained. Well, that's a pretty brutal prescription for people who've lived a certain way all their lives. And there's a condescension to it that is there in the novel, in the doctor who thinks of himself as a humanist, but really doesn't know how to talk to people outside his world, outside his class. And his daughter is actually the one who keeps pointing that out and picking up on it and criticizing him. Anyway, I appreciate your comment and your question, and I appreciate that you're a reader of mine. Thank you.
One of the passages that stuck with me over the years from The Unwinding was I can't remember his first name, but somebody named Russo described in Youngstown the sort of lack of, or the loss of, blue-collar jobs. If a plague had taken away this many people in the Midwest, it would be considered a huge historical event. Obviously,
that was John Russo of Youngstown State, and that analogy really struck me, because we think of deindustrialization as a sort of natural, inevitable process, like climate change or something. Maybe it has some human effect, but it's not something that can easily be reversed. Well, no, deindustrialization came with a series of policies and deregulation of finance and of other industries, and it was implemented by people who were benefiting from it, people whose connections were more to world finance than to a local factory. And it's just now that it's too late for so much of the country, both parties seem to have woken up to it, but they should have been mindful of it back in the 90s when Doug first moved to his town.
Yeah. Well, do you think you're reaching people? Do you think you would reach America's yeomen, so to speak, with this book? Your upstate neighbor, maybe?
You know, Brian, it's hard to know, because how many people still read fiction? How many people read literary fiction that isn't just in a genre like sci-fi or fantasy? I hope I do, and I hope I reach them more profoundly than in my journalism, because when you are inside these characters who are moving through the world and experiencing the tearing up of a family and of a society, it ought to hit you in a way that reporting might not be able to. If the book just came out, I don't know who's reading it yet, but I wouldn't write if I didn't want to reach people. The entire purpose, the impulse, is to take what I feel and think and see and to convey it to people who are not me and who are very unlike me. And that's the meaning of my life. So I hope so.
We had another caller who couldn't stay on the line, but Noelle from Carbondale wanted to ask if there was a reference to organized religion in the book. So, I mean, I'll let you answer that. I would set that up by saying not as such, but there certainly are, religious-ish ideas that grip both the burghers in the city and the yeomen in the countryside.
That's exactly right. That would be my answer. I mean, there are many things from our society that are not here. There's no digital technology. The economy is different from our information economy. And there isn't an established church or conventional religions as we know them. But you're right. The young people in both the city and the countryside have produced these new ways of thinking that are religious. They're not religious in the conventional sense. But for example, the young men on the farms have embraced a way of thinking called dirt thought, which is essentially a worship of animals, physical strength, violence, maleness. It's a very masculine belief system. And they're in constant training for some conflict with the city people. And they've come to despise the city people, which is what happens to the daughter of the doctor when she encounters this young farm boy. So there's something primitive and almost animistic about that way of thinking, but it won't strike readers as parallel in any way to Judaism, Christianity, Islam, etc.
No, I was thinking more of the manosphere as I was reading about dirt
thought.
Yeah,
I think that's probably the closest religion I've got. And in the city, well, I'm not going to use the W word. I hate it. But that's probably the closest to the philosophy of together.
Well, the people are wide awake, right? We'll let people intuit from there. Let me think of where to take this. So one of the other quotes that I had ringing in my head was from as I was reading your book, was from a British filmmaker named Adam Curtis, who, you know, often has spoken to left or liberal audiences and kind of confronts them with the idea of, do you really want change or do you just want the bankers to be a little nicer, you know, for people to be more respectful of each other's identities? And one of the things that some of your characters struggle with is, you know, maybe when together, the sort of guiding philosophy in the city is not the utopian promise that it had been held out as. Can you talk about that?
Well, it becomes coercive, morally coercive. And instead of fixing the physical problems of the city, the problems are getting worse. The trash isn't getting collected. Food is not arriving from the countryside because the yeomen have begun blocking the roads to the food and produce trucks. So instead, it is fixing language. It's fixing the way people talk to each other. And it's producing a kind of utopian idea of what a human being should be, which is a machine. It's pushing the young into a transformation in this workshop into what I call better humans, which are like metallic robots, pre-digital robots that take the place of the individual. It's this radical idea of, in a sense, getting rid of our humanity. The same is going on the countryside where the young men are taking on animal identities. So that's sort of the direction of life. And the doctor, the key character, he is a liberal. He is a man who believes in compromise and reason, but he also likes his place. He likes his status. And when he finds himself losing his status in the new order and losing the respect of his daughter and his hospital and his community, it sort of strips him down, and he has to confront whether his complacent kind of humanism really is a moral code or whether it's just a matter of social status. And so I think that both what's for me good about liberalism, it, you know, its emphasis on humaneness and on dialogue, and what's naive about it is sort of packed into this one character who I put through the ringer over the course of the novel.
All right, we need to take another break, after which we'll hear the conclusion of my conversation with the writer George Packer. His novel is The Emergency. We first broadcast this in November and are listening to it today because our original guest asked to reschedule. That was Steve Botsford, a candidate in the Democratic primary for U.S. Senate. You can find past and future conversations with other Senate candidates at our website, 21stshow.org, or look us up wherever you get your podcasts. More to come after a short break. This is The 21st Show. It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Let's get back to the conclusion of my conversation with George Packer, first broadcast in November. His new novel is called The Emergency, an allegorical story in the tradition of George Orwell's 1984, Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale, about dystopian near futures that are both familiar and quite strange. And we first broadcast this conversation in November, so we are not taking calls today, but you can let us know what you thought. Our email address is talk@21stshow.org. George Packer is also a staff writer at The Atlantic magazine, where he writes about American politics and foreign policy. And I wonder if I could ask you a little bit about some of your recent work there. You recently had a piece that was headlined, "We Are Living in an Authoritarian State." And you talk about, you know, you can take your dog for a walk, you can watch a football game. It feels normal, but even that is disorienting, paralyzing. Talk about this moment we're living in and why you think we are now in an authoritarian state.
There's no clear line that you could say, now we've crossed it. It's more like a fog rolling in. But when you take stock of all the traditional checks on the power of the leader in our democracy, Congress, the Supreme Court, the civil service, independent agencies in the federal government, the media, corporations, civil society, universities, all of the institutions that either whose purpose is to serve as a check or that simply function that way as they carry out their own duties. One by one, they have all been either cowed or co-opted or simply fallen silent. It doesn't mean that the Gestapo are going to knock down your door, although ICE might seem that way to people who look like they might be illegal immigrants and need to be rounded up by people wearing masks without identifying badges. That gets closer to the traditional image of an authoritarian state. But the modern authoritarian state is not the 30s, Germany, Italy, Soviet Union. It is much more of a kind of hybrid where there are elections, but those elections get less and less free and fair over time. Where there is a legislature, but the legislature is in the hands of the ruling party, which has decided to give the leader what he wants. And the media isn't silenced, but it is bought off by the rich friends of the leader. And whenever there's pressure applied, whether it's financial or legal, they cave in. All of that to me feels like a version of authoritarianism that I wanted our readers to be aware of, not to say it's hopeless, we're now under a nightfall of dictatorship, but to say, see it clearly, even though it may not taste or feel like it all the time, see clearly what kind of power has been brought to bear over our lives and how few outlets there still are for opposing it.
Why? What is your hypothesis as to why so many individuals and institutions, I mean, Trump won by 1.5% last time around. It wasn't, you know, so I mean, yes, if you look at the map and the electoral college is what it is, but it wasn't like a Reagan-Mondale style victory. And yet, you know, there's the CEO of Apple handing him a golden idol or medal or whatever it was. You know, one of the moments that really has stuck in my brain this year. What is your hypothesis as to why people have fallen in line so quickly?
Cowardice, in a single word. A calculation that their own interests have to be aligned with what Trump wants if they're going to be left alone to do their business and make their money and go on as they've always gone. And also maybe lack of imagination, just not understanding how quickly we have gotten to a state in which our ability to function as a democracy is threatened. We've been used to a democracy all our lives, with many, many imperfections, but we've never encountered this, at least in my lifetime. And so it takes an effort to see it, to recognize what's going on. That's one reason why I turn to fiction, because I do think the imagination has to be exercised in order to see reality more clearly. And when we wake up in the morning and find that everything is the same as always, the coffee tastes the same, the park looks the same, the train is the same, you don't feel in your nervous system how much has actually changed. So it's an effort you have to make all the time, because you're not going to have it knocking you over the head unless you're very unlucky.
How do you think, and we talked about this a little at the beginning, but you know, with the idea that we now have different sort of realities, we no longer have a shared reality, at least, which one wonders how a democracy can function without that. But specifically the fact-seeking institutions in our society, right? Journalism, higher education, courts. Do you see a way forward for them?
Well, I think, first of all, especially my own profession, journalism, and an adjacent one, higher education, have to recognize that we had some of this coming. We became insular. We got comfortable just talking to ourselves and to people who think alike. Social media and the algorithms that make it profitable drive academics and journalists into their bubbles, where they can be sure that they'll be in sync with everyone in their peer group. And by the way, there are analogies to this in the emergency. They are physical. They're not online, but there are physical groups where people feel this pressure to all agree. Well, that alienated a lot of Americans. It made them feel as if, well, these institutions are serving themselves. There's no public interest in the media. There's no civic function. It's just a self-interested clique that is making money and telling lies, even when it isn't telling lies. How do you overcome that distrust? It's really difficult. There is no simple way to do it, except to begin by acknowledging, yeah, we have kind of fallen into ourselves and lost contact with the larger public, which is why Trump's election in 2016 was such a total shock to my trade, journalism.
Yeah. Although I also wonder how much, even if, you know, we, the sort of fact-based, standards-based media, try to do better, if there's still, you know, outside forces, other types of media that are constantly going to be attacking, I wonder how much it even matters, right? Because people don't even consume the same media
anymore.
Well,
that's absolutely right. There's only so much we can do. And we actually do a pretty good job. I know what the fact-checking and editing process is like at The Atlantic, and it's incredibly rigorous and takes a lot of time and money. The reading public may not really even grasp how much effort we take to get it right. And then in the end, who's reading it? Who does it reach? Who believes it? Well, people who are getting their news from TikTok might not know or care what The Atlantic or public radio or The New York Times has to say. And so there is this giant divide that is the biggest threat of all to journalism, irrelevance, the fact that we might have really no effect on creating at least some baseline of facts that people can start from and then have their political arguments and disagree with each other.
So you've said in another interview with Yasha Monk that there's more than, or maybe he said it, there's a little of you in Hugo, the main character. I wonder if you're willing to say what sort of values or principles or ideas you had about the way the world works that you have maybe let go of and which ones you want to cling to.
Well, the relationship between Hugo Rustin, the doctor, and his daughter, it's not directly based on what we talk about at my dinner table, but you can be sure that my desire to stay close to my children, even as the whole world seems to be taking them away, changing into a form that I didn't recognize and didn't anticipate when I was young. I never thought we would be living in a world like this. It's important to make sure the bonds stay tight. But then you have to ask yourself, what am I prepared to give up? And then what am I going to hold on to? And for me, and for the doctor, the core values have to be a sense of the recognizing the humanity of the other person, even if it's someone we deeply disagree with and don't even recognize. There still has to be some basic respect for the other as a person. There has to be some common decency, which I see leaving our country. That's what worries me the most, Brian, is like a moral collapse, which is echoed in our language, which has deteriorated into kind of a corrosive language of contempt. And once we despise each other based on politics or on identity, I don't know how a democracy can survive, because democracy actually relies on us to be able to form civic bonds that we can then act through, even if we don't agree. So for me, the novel ends with the doctor having made huge mistakes, gotten himself and his daughter into serious difficulties, life-changing difficulties. In the end, he recognizes that he has to just continue to do what he knows how to do, which is to help people who are ailing, to help the injured while there's a civil war going on all around his home. And that's the common humanity that I hope we haven't lost yet. It's not a grand philosophy. It's not a political ideology. It's a basic recognition that we owe each other something as fellow creatures, and that we have to acknowledge the humanity of the other in order to have any kind of future together.
One of the things that Rustin sort of wrestles with is his own optimism, right? At the beginning, there's a scene where he tells his wife, oh, this is a fad. You know, things always work out well for us, right? People like us, I think he's saying. Are you generally optimistic, pessimistic? How would you rate your own mood about our short-term and long-term future?
Well, the line you quoted is should have a pretty ironic echo to it. The reader should think,
yes.
Well, it may not work out so well for them. That's more like naivete than optimism. I retain faith in this country and in the future at this point, largely because I have children and I can't give up on the future because that's their world. But my sense of where we are, where we're going, how quickly it's happening, and how many people seem prepared to accept it makes me pretty anxious for the near future. But there's no way I can possibly give up on this country, which I love, and on the future of my children, whom I love. And those are the basic emotions that I hope the novel emphasizes, so that the reader doesn't feel, this is just about decline and destruction, but it's also about what we owe each other across these divides.
The book is called The Emergency. The author is George Packer. George, thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with me today.
I really enjoy the conversation. Thank you, Brian.
That's all the time we have for our program today. Coming up on tomorrow's show, we're going to be talking about a surge in flu, RSV, and COVID cases across Illinois. Plus, we'll revisit the topic of K-cars, a new conversation. President Trump wants to bring these tiny Japanese cars into America. The laws, though, are complicated, including here in Illinois. We'll try to untangle some of what is happening there. That's all coming up tomorrow on the 21st show. You can find a podcast of our program wherever you listen. We're on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, and every other platform. Just search for The 21st Show. You can also find links to our podcasts at our website, 21stshow.org. While you're there, you can find every way to contact us, social media, email address, voicemail line, and you can join our texting group. It's a great way we keep in touch with listeners to let them know what we are talking about on future programs, and we seek your comments and questions for our guests, especially when we have to tape conversations. That is particularly helpful. We love being able to still have you put questions to the people we talk to here on the 21st show. You can join that by sending the word talk to 217-803-0730. Again, just text the word talk, T-A-L-K, to 217-803-0730. The 21st show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.